She's a business mogul.
Number one.
And wellness expert.
How can I help?
And now Chantel Ray and her amazing guests are here to guide you on your wellness journey.
Time to level up.
Welcome to the Waste Away Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to today's episode, and I'm so excited. We have Merrick Doyle, and today we're talking all things health. We're talking about functional medicine and so much more. We're talking about digestion. We're talking about inflammation, all the fun things. So Merrick, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So one of the questions that we have a lot of listener questions today, and one of the first question is from Laura in Arkansas, and she says, I've heard that magnesium supplements can possibly block the absorption of oxalates in food. Have you ever heard of that, and what is your thoughts? Another thing is that I have major leg cramps at night. Even if I take magnesium, sometimes I get leg cramps at night and I'm not sleeping well at night. I need some helpful tips on what I can do to sleep. And that's from Laura in Arkansas.
Okay. So yeah, first of all, magnesium and oxalates do share an important relationship. Magnesium binds with the oxalic acid. And what's interesting there is that you're going to get a partially soluble salt there. Now, I appreciate that sounds like jargon. Why is that important? Because a lot of the oxalates in food are soluble. If you were to take magnesium with some soluble oxalates that's coming from the food, you're actually going to reduce the absorption. But if the oxalates in food happen to be insoluble, then you could actually make them more absorbable. So that's a mixed bag for magnesium. And this is the reason why magnesium's role in oxalate issues can be quite confusing. And you'll often see online these recommendations to take magnesium with food. But I would say, whilst it's not automatically a bad thing, you would be best off blocking the absorption of oxalates with calcium, which always forms insoluble oxalates, much harder to absorb. That's not to say that we shouldn't add the magnesium, but I'd be keen to take it away from the food.
So I've actually got an article
on my website about that magnesium usage.
So let's back up for just a second, because I want to, for people who haven't heard of oxalates yet, I want to kind of talk a little bit. And just so you guys know, foods that are high in oxalates, things like spinach, chard, kale, soy products, potatoes, almonds, beets,
chocolate, unfortunately.
Chocolate, yeah. So when you eat those things, if you're not feeling good, talk a little bit about what those foods do. I know one of the things that high oxalate diet could lead to people having kidney stones. But what are some other reactions that people eat? Like if they have a gut dysfunction, they might need to limit it. What are some of the things if they eat those things? Like if they say, okay, well, every time I eat chocolate or if I have spinach or I have some of these things, I feel what?
So this is the key thing. A lot of people aren't going to have any issues whatsoever with oxalates unless they have especially high quantities. Oxalates are a natural pesticide in plants that discourage predators from eating them. Key thing being that humans have counter-evolved to handle them. And there's various things that go on in our digestive tract to neutralize them. Part of that is bacterial degradation, but also we can bind up those oxalates and carry those out. Without going into too much detail, if there's disturbed conditions in the gut, if we have a change in the bacterial populations, we can now be vulnerable to absorbing the oxalates. And when we do, we're likely to see them accumulate in our bloodstream, and they can start to form crystals, inflammatory crystals, which can cause inflammation wherever they end up settling. And that's where we can see a very different pattern between one person with oxalates and the next. So yes, the kidney stones are the single most common, or at least the most discussed problem associated with oxalates. But some people will get skin rashes. Other people will get joint pain. Other people will get irritation of the bladder, find themselves needing to urinate repeatedly. And when they get to the loo, there's very little to prompt such a call to go there. So this is where, we always want to track, is there any inflammatory pattern that occurs when people consume these high oxalate foods? And often we'll see sparkly urine as well, which a lot of people find quite astonishing when I talk about it, until, of course, they actually see the sparkling in the urine they've voided into the toilet bowl. So, it's important to recognize that individual nature, but inflammation is always the main effect. To a certain extent, we want to consider the way that they can collate minerals as well and make them less available. But yes, it's an inflammatory thing, but how that inflammation manifests definitely varies from one person to the next.
Did you guys know that 97% of Americans are deficient in at least one mineral? It's true. You need more than a dozen minerals for your body to function at its best, but with the standard American diet, it's almost impossible. So here's where Beam Minerals comes in. Guess what? All you have to do, take one little shot of this one little shot of this one, and guess what? It looks like this, but it tastes like water. Take one shot, and boom, in 30 seconds a day, you're getting an entire thing of minerals instead of an entire cabinet of supplement bottles. So with Beam Minerals, we make mineral balance simple. So I wanted you to talk a little bit more about what you said about some of these plants and how in order for them to, because it really makes sense when people think like, okay, you know, God made plants, so, you know, we should be eating them. But one of the things, I want you to explain it in a really easy way of like, plants want, they don't want other things to eat them. So they put off these oxalates, kind of explain that pattern.
Yeah, so clearly at some point over the course of evolution, a plant developed the ability to concentrate these oxalates. And consequently, the predators that would normally have eaten them could no longer do so. And therefore, it aided their survival. Therefore, this was a setup that was perpetuated by evolution. And that's where, we can look at that as a clear natural pesticide effect. But it's also the case that we're not having huge amounts of spinach, most people will go through their life without even having to think about oxalates because they will be neutralized in our guts. But when they're not, that's where we get the problems.
So good. So let's talk a little bit more about that question that she had. So she's saying that when she has taking magnesium, and then she is getting leg cramps when she's taking magnesium. I personally think when you're taking magnesium, it's the balance of magnesium and potassium is where people are getting it wrong, where they're taking too much magnesium, not balancing it with potassium. And in general, they say that you should be having about 4,300 milligrams of potassium in a day. And very few people are having that much potassium in a day. And I know for me, I get leg cramps when I'm not eating enough potassium. What's your thoughts on that?
So it's funny you mentioned the dosage because, it's often the case that, we see any sort of cramps, then question number one is that individual getting enough magnesium? And so sometimes I'll see people supplemented with magnesium, but they're actually not getting enough. So typically 400, 500 milligrams per day is where I would, you know, look at as the sort of level I would expect to make an obvious difference. Meanwhile, yeah, you mentioned a really good point about potassium because that also plays a big role. And so, yeah, the interesting thing is how much are people consuming of the potassium? Are they getting enough of that as well? But also, one very under-discussed challenge is whether the potassium is getting into cells. So we talk a lot about insulin and its role in driving glucose into the cells. And yeah, it does that. That's pretty important. But it also pushes potassium in. So you might be able to guess where I'm going with this. If there's any sense of insulin resistance, that's often where we're going to need to really up our potassium. So sometimes people just aren't getting enough, not enough fruit and vegetables. Other times they're eating quite a lot, still noticing that they're showing the signs of low potassium. That's especially something I would look at if people are getting dry lips, dry mouth, a feeling of weakness in the limbs without actually being weak. Increased sock marks. They take their socks off and there's a dent there in the ankles. And frequent urination. So if they're noticing those things, then yeah, potassium is absolutely where I would want to go with
it. So you're saying if they're frequently urinating at night or just during the day, that's another sign of low potassium?
So the interesting thing when it comes to frequent urination, there can be a number of causes, but by far and away, the top two is low potassium or low sodium. So if it's low sodium, we'd be looking at dizziness upon standing, cold hands and feet, a sensation of general fogginess, as well as salt cravings and frequent urination. Whereas, yeah, I mentioned the alternative profile we'd expect when potassium short. Sometimes the body will waste potassium in order to maintain its desired sodium to potassium ratio, which it actually prioritizes over potassium. So sometimes we can throw a whole load of potassium in, but it won't hit, it won't actually do the job unless we also take care of the sodium. So yeah, I think we've already touched on one of these common threads whereby there's often one thing that's driving the symptoms, but how we got there can involve a number of systems. What I would say is that if that frequent urination is purely at nighttime or purely at specific times of day, then that is likely to be a sodium thing, but the time of day pattern is a pretty strong giveaway for the adrenals playing a role. The adrenals are the one system in our body that has this diurnal rhythm. It changes over the course of the day. And so, yeah, if there's ever these issues or any pattern that we see that comes reliably at the same time of day, then I would absolutely be looking at adrenal performance and what we can do to support the adrenals. But yes, in the context of sodium and potassium, if it's a nighttime thing, I would put good money on sodium being involved, but also the fact that there's low cortisol activity, meaning that they can't retain the sodium, because cortisol has lots of roles, one of which is retaining the sodium.
Guys, I just want to interrupt for just a second, and I want you to hear Paul Saladino talk about why liver is so important. And if you don't like liver, we have another option for you.
Your ancestors were eating liver. And the reason that this sort of wisdom has been passed down is because liver is very nutritious. It's basically nature's multivitamin. If you look at the nutrients in meat, they're great. You've got zinc, you got B6, you got B12, you got some K2. But if you look at liver, it really complements what's in muscle meat. And there are many unique nutrients found in organs, specifically liver as a powerhouse of these, that are difficult to obtain outside of liver. Like meat and organs are like peanut butter and jelly. They just go together. They're supposed to be eaten together. the easiest way to eat liver is just to do it raw. If you don't want to eat liver raw, you can cook it. But the reason that I like to do it raw is because there are unique nutrients in liver that are probably somewhat degraded when you cook the liver.
This really is like the most nutrient-rich supplements that you can find. And they are amazing. I have tried them. I absolutely love them. So just go to heartandsoil.co, use the coupon code Chantel Ray, and save you some money there.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, finding that balance between the magnesium and the potassium, also vitamin B12, I think is another one that can help with leg cramps. And then the final thing, I love what you said about the sodium, because, and making sure that it gets in the cell and getting that good salt, like the Celtic sea salt, putting that on your tongue or using that in your food, using some of that Celtic sea salt. Would be definitely key. And I love what you said about the adrenals. So talk about that a little bit more. What would someone do to help with their adrenals in that case?
So yeah, one thing that you can do is to measure your adrenal output. And you can do that using urinary testing, such as the Dutch panel, but also the classic adrenal stress profile, which is a saliva test. And the useful thing about both is that you get to measure your cortisol and DHEA output over the course of the day. That's important because single point measures are never going to be able to give us the full picture when it comes to the adrenals, for that reason that I mentioned, it's a diurnal rhythm. So it changes over the course of the day. Now, key thing that we want to look at there is sometimes we'll see a really obvious pattern. That is to say, not enough cortisol is being produced. And that's where looking to support it, potentially with licorice root or potentially one of the adaptogenic herbs, Korean ginseng, Siberian ginseng, or eleutherope, as it is called on your side of the pond, or even ashwagandha, they can, rhodiola, rosea as well, they can all play a really important role there. One nuance that's worth touching on is that sometimes we'll see high levels of cortisol on the test, but we'll still see the classic low cortisol pattern. So yes, inability to retain the sodium and the frequent urination, but also slow to wake up in the morning, slow to switch off at night, that energy dip in the afternoon, that difficulty in falling asleep if you miss the window, finding you really got that limit on when you can go to bed, finding that exercise in the afternoon or the evening will mess with sleep, finding that we can feel substantially worse for stress, mysterious inflammatory symptoms that don't tend to sort themselves out and don't respond the way that they should, so on and so forth. So that's where, yeah, we'll often still see low cortisol activity despite high readings on the test. And that paradox actually isn't too paradoxical, because if somebody's been under high stress for a long period of time, we'll always expect their cortisol receptors to downregulate, meaning that they're not getting the cortisol effect regardless of how high it is. And even then, that's when, yeah, we'll often want to look at similar sort of support, even though the test results are saying that it's high, which I know is, yeah, something that feels counterintuitive for many.
Yeah, one of the things that I love, it's something called B minerals, and it really helps with hydration, muscle regeneration, and endurance. And basically, the B minerals contain a plant-based humic and fulvic minerals, and they provide micronutrients, trace amino acids, and they also include electrolytes. And so, you know, it basically helps with the calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. So I try to take those B minerals. Those are really amazing. And then I also, like in this Boss water, I just add one scoop of electrolytes, like an electrolyte powder, and put that in. And that also helps me with leg cramps and definitely like every day, like trying to eat like a sweet potato, coconut water, you know, really focusing on high potassium foods is so, so important for me because I can really relate to this person because I really have a problem sometimes with leg cramps. One time I was at the Restore cryotherapy and they were doing the compression, you know, the compression sleeves on your legs. And I was sitting there and literally, I'm not joking, all of a sudden I started like almost screaming. I was like, oh my gosh, help, help. And my calf muscle just like really started spazzing. And the nurse came over. And the funny thing is, you know what? The first thing she gave me, she said, here, put this in your mouth. And it was a packet of mustard. And I hate mustard. She's like, you have to take this. So I took the mustard and literally within seconds, I mean, probably less than 30 seconds, the cramp stopped. And she's like, oh yeah, that's an emergency room trick that we use because those mustard packets have so much sodium in them. And so she's like, and instantly my leg cramp went away. I thought that was funny. So what you said about the sodium levels is so, so true.
No, it's interesting that, yeah, electrolytes are probably the one thing that has such a quick effect. There's no try this for 3 weeks and see how you get on. There's none of that when it comes to the electrolytes. You will normally be able to make a conclusion within minutes, not days.
So one of the things that you are an expert at is just inflammation and gut issues. And so we're hearing a lot of people just really still struggling that they've said, you know, they've got fatigue and constant chronic constipation and, you know, just, you know, having trouble with bowel movements. Anemia is a big thing that people are still struggling with. So I want to kind of see if you can see when you have patients come in, what are some of the things that are, obviously there's so many causes, right? But if you had to name kind of the top three issues with, you know, chronic inflammatory bowel disease or any kind of diseases of the gut, what are you seeing are the biggest things that are issues for them?
So I suspect the easiest to touch on the number one factor, which is stress. And in that regard, it's obviously something that sometimes is difficult to talk about because we use this label stress. And what does that mean? It can mean different things to different people. I am referring to stress specifically as any circumstance where your body detects a need for more resources than it's currently got. And so it launches the stress response to bridge that gap, to mobilize resources into the circulation to try and meet this expected demand. But as part of that, we're going to see a disinvestment in the intestinal function. And that's by design. It's a really smart move by the human body to temporarily disinvest in what would otherwise be quite a big energy investment in the guts. We use about 30% of our energy every day purely in digestion. And that's a great, you know, return on investment. We get all the energy back from that. So that's no problem. But to have that capacity to temporarily turn off the amount of resources going that way and use them for survival-based tasks, the here and the now, well, that's a really big asset. But it becomes a problem when it's no longer happening temporarily and that's locked in place, because now there's going to be less acid production in the stomach, less bile release from the gallbladder, less enzymes released from the pancreas, less blood flow to the gut. Things are going to shut down. And when they do, we're not only going to feel quite uncomfortable, but also we're likely to see perfect conditions for some of the bad guys to take that opportunity and drive inflammatory processes. We've got perfect conditions for fermentation and all these bacterial products now leaking into the circulation.
And not only that, when we're under stress, it's not just about the body dumping its energy reserves. It's also about the opening up of the gut lining, which does actually help grab the sugars and salts. So great, but at a cost, which is now, yeah, you've got these channels inside the cells that line the gut. And that's where little fragments of dead bacteria, the endotoxins, aka the lipopolysaccharides, they can now get in and cause all manner of inflammatory events that can disturb energy signaling, wreck hormonal receptor sensitivity, something we touched on earlier. So, yeah, and that's where we're going to pay the costs of any imbalances in the gut much more so than we otherwise would. So I feel like, yeah, whenever I see somebody who's had long-term gut issues, they've seen 17, 18 practitioners beforehand, then my number one question will always be not, is there a special protocol that all the others missed? It's more, well, why is this individual not responded to such protocols? Or to rephrase, do they have a fair chance of responding? And universally, the answer has been no. There hasn't been the energy security, the resources to actually go ahead and invest in gut activity. And sure enough, the body doesn't do that. And that's where we'll often want to take some preliminary steps to actually re-engage that investment to harness much better conditions in the gut. And then the very same protocols that failed so many times, suddenly they start to work.
Did you guys know that your thyroid's main food is iodine? And guess what? Mercury and other toxins gobble up your selenium, and your thyroid glands need selenium to convert iodine to thyroxine. So if you have mercury fillings and with all the toxins and mold, your selenium just gets gobbled up. So here's the bottom line. I take something called Peak Thyroid. It's got iodine, it's got copper, and it's got selenium. Everything you need to get your thyroid back to functioning without medicine. So go to ChantelRayWay.com/upgraded formulas. Use the coupon code ChantelRay to get a huge discount. Yeah, I think people underestimate. I love that you said that, because I think stress is such an important piece of inflammation, and people don't take the time to find ways, and I'm one of the biggest culprits, to find ways to help them relax and figure out, you know, whether it's meditation or a bubble bath or going for a walk or yoga, and figuring out how they can incorporate some of these, like taking deep breaths, and figuring out how they can get those practices to giving them long-term health and, you know, getting us out of the fight or flight mode. Because I know for me, like for so long, I have just lived in that fight or flight mode, and just being able to manage all of our functional gastrointestinal disorders by just getting rid of all of that stress. And I love that you said that. What about probiotics? Because I think that people also underestimate that. I know I now have up to a 200 billion, I think it's 200 billion, maybe it's 100 million.
Oh, this is
billion, 200 million, sorry, probiotic. And I want you to just talk about how that can promote a healthy gut bacteria and how important that is.
So, yeah, what's so relevant is that our bodies are constantly establishing the best metabolic programs to run and the best mode of action in response to environmental signals. Now, to put things into context, there's about 2.5 meters squared of our body that's in contact with the environment directly outside of us, whereas there's 600 meters squared that's in contact with the environment at the gut lining. So yeah, this is a hugely influential factor as to, well, what is the immune system going to be tasked with doing? This sets the tone for the entire immune system's leanings from that point onwards. So yes, if you have a whole host of undesirable microbes that cause inflammatory issues, well, guess what? You've got millions of nerve endings of your vagus nerve embedded into the gut lining to constantly assess what's going on here. Is there any signs of chaos that could potentially spill over into the bloodstream this side of the barrier and cause an energy emergency? And sure enough, if it detects any potential chaos, it's going to communicate that, and we are going to see the vagal nerve do what it's designed to do and reduce energy investment. And that means, yeah, less is going to go into healing, less is going to go into tasks that will serve our future purposes, but also less is going to be invested here, prefrontal cortex, one of the most energy intensive zones of the brain, hugely responsible for clear thinking, verbal fluidity, the executive function, and also mood. But none of that actually helps us survive here and now. Hence why something's going on in our gut, we're going to feel awful. That's a universal. As well as, of course, we've got the inflammatory challenges, which are going to potentially cause insult to various tissues, potentially symptoms through that means, and an ongoing inflammatory leaning that can spill over into cellular level, potentially affecting energy production, at which point your body's got less resources. What does it do when it has less resources? Mounts the stress response in order to bridge that gap, to bump up what's available in the bloodstream. We've now got ourselves a self-perpetuating cycle. So yeah, the importance of what's going on in the gut, the microbial populations there, we just can't overstate that. And of course, it isn't a coincidence that most people who've been on a long healing journey will be able to look back and say, do you know what, when I added this probiotic, that shifted me into a brand new place. Also, we should point out that if there isn't space in the gut, if the conditions are particularly ripe for all these competitive strains, these undesirables, this is where probiotics may well have done such wonderful things for friends, family, neighbors, but in those circumstances, they don't have a fair chance. So yeah, absolutely a vital step for a lot of people at some point towards going from not feeling great to feeling great. But often when they're used is quite key.
So obviously eating an anti-inflammatory diet and reducing your intake of highly processed foods and refined carbs and sugar and alcohol obviously is one of the most important things. But everyone seems these days with functional medicines, they're kind of torn on what they believe are anti-inflammatory foods, right? So like people are like, well, vegetables, but, you know, not having high oxalate vegetables or having these fruits. And some people are like, no, too much fruit isn't good. So talk about, for you, what does your diet look like? Like, what is a day in the life of the foods that you eat and that you kind of really recommend for your clients?
Okay, so the foods that I eat on a daily basis might vary quite a lot from the foods I recommend for a client. And that being said, just the recommendations I'll make from one client to the next will vary substantially. So I'll typically employ a ketogenic diet some of the time and then a carbohydrate-based diet other times. That works nicely for me. This morning I had a protein shake followed by porridge, and then at lunchtime I've had eggs followed by fruits in yogurt. This evening I'm not actually sure what I'll be eating. I'll actually know what's fucked up when I head in, but I'm pretty sure I saw a chili in the slow cooker when I was in the main house earlier. So I'm imagining that we're looking along those lines, likely with some rice, green beans, or similar. So yeah, that's a very normal day. That's not something that, you know, is what I will have every day. But the key thing being that for some people, absolutely, there's going to be a need to avoid the oxalate. But if you don't have a problem with them, then there's not much call to do so. Equally, some people will find that lectins, another natural plant pesticide, may well be an issue. Another issue, much less common, but occurs plenty of times, salicylates. Other people may well find that higher histamine food, so any aged meats, anything that's fermented, or indeed items that may initiate the release of histamine, like avocados. Yeah, this is the issue. So the key thing is, if you're feeling good, you've made a change in your diet and you feel better, then it is very easy to start second guessing. And in those circumstances, there's just no need to.
I don't know about you guys, but I am stressed. And if you're feeling overwhelmed this holiday season, then I get it. With all the family get-togethers, it is just a relentless source of stress. But anyway, there is something that I've got called Stress Guardian, and it's actually made by Bioptimizers, the people who make the magnesium breakthrough, which I love, love, love. But anyway, they are literally made this new product. It has 14 adaptogenic herbs, and it just regulates your stress. I just actually took some right this second, and it's awesome. If you go to stressguardian.com/wasteaway and put in wasteaway for 10% off your first order, it's stressguardian.com/wasteaway. Go there now. So let me ask you, we don't even use that term porridge. Is that oatmeal? Is that what you, when you...
That it is oatmeal. So that's a lost in translation thing that I should have thought through. But yes, porridge on this side of the pond is oatmeal on that side of the pond. So,
which grains right now is a very, you know, hot topic, because some people are saying, you know, grains, you know, cause inflammation. So what is your thoughts on that? And what is your opinion on having grains and even gluten-free breads and stuff like that?
Yeah, so key thing there is that grains have definitely been demonized. And there's a reason for that, because enough people feel a whole lot better when they remove them. Obviously, there is, two points that I would make there. When they remove grains, what are they replacing them with? That could have a really big bearing on whether they feel better or not. But equally, we see research that shows consistently that if there's already inflammatory cascades going on in the gut, then, the ATIs, trypsin inhibitors, these are compounds that can potentially flare that. And so this is where it's not only just a personal thing, but also it's something that can change from somebody who is currently dealing with gut issues, maybe to get relief from taking out grains, and then fast forward several months, circumstances are very different, they bring the grains back in and it's no longer the same challenge. But yeah, there's also the potential for the gluten to be an issue and other grains to be just fine. A lot of people find that wheat messes with them, but hey, rice is just fine. So that is a very useful point of reference to demonstrate exactly where we do want to take a look at the individual responses, because as to say that grains are fine and everybody should have 6 to 11 servings a day is fairly ridiculous. But equally, to demonize grains, that's not something that I think we need to do either.
we go back to a listener question, and this is from Carrie in Virginia Beach. And she says, I have a friend who wants me to go in their sauna all the time. And I get it. There's tons of benefits from inducing the sweating from the heat. And it also has, you know, endorphin release. And there's so many benefits that we could list on and on. But every time I go into the sauna, I feel terrible. So I've tried it several times and I don't understand, but I just want to cut it out. Is there anything I'm doing wrong? And what is your opinion on what I should do if I still want to have all the benefits, but I don't want to feel bad when I go into the sauna?
So I have seen this pattern occur quite a lot over the years. And in most cases, not all, but most cases, we can get around it by recognizing how these problems occur and then matching a solution to them. So what happens with the sauna? Well, the major beneficial effects come from inducing these family of proteins called the heat shock proteins, which, to overly generalize, enhance cellular function. Great. And this is one of the reasons why there's just so many benefits for saunas. You look at anything that tracks sauna usage versus pretty much any health condition, any risk of any kind, you always see a positive outcome there. But there is one particular heat shock protein, heat shock protein 70, and this is a protein that needs high levels of cellular energy. That's ATP. It needs high levels of energy in order to be formed properly. If it's not formed properly, as in you have a sauna while the cells are low in ATP, then it's actually going to cause a little bit of chaos and people tend to feel horrendous. Now, you can actually inhibit that one specific heat protein using a herb called cat's claw. And so, yeah, this is the often known as Chinese cat's claw, gu teng, just to identify it from similar sounding herbs. But yeah, the key thing there is you still get the other heat shock proteins. The rest of the family can still go ahead and do their beneficial effects. But this one problematic protein, which is not a bad protein, it just has this tendency to go off track. Suddenly, we've neutralized those effects. So occasionally, it's more to do with the heat and its effects on just ramping up immune function. That's sometimes a thing, but yeah, the cat's claw intervention has been remarkably helpful for a lot of people who have these issues. And yeah, sure enough, there isn't any information out there. They have this mysterious effect that no one can explain. But when we look at the mechanisms, it becomes a whole lot.
So good. Well, this has been amazing. Tell listeners where they can find you and where they can follow you.
Okay, so my website is marekdoyle.com. My Instagram is marekdoylenutrition, and the Substack is marekdoyle.substack.com. So I'm sure there'll be enough content to keep people between the three sources I've just dropped.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for all that you are doing to help people's health and take their health to the next level. And you guys stay tuned. We've got another episode coming up in just a few. Bye-bye for now.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, it would mean the world to us for you to leave a review on iTunes to get this podcast out to others that may have the same questions that you do. And as always, if you have a question that you want answered, email those to questions@chantelrayway.com. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.